You're listening to the LA Rams Reports Flipping the Tables podcast.
First and 10 from the 27. Warner back to throw. Rainbow's the far sideline, and it is caught by Isaac Bruce. Makes a move to the 30, 25, 20, and they won't catch him today.
Yes. 73.
Touchdown Rams!
73 yards for the Reverend Ike.
And now, here's your hosts, Josh Webb and Cameron Worrell.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a delayed, but better late than never episode of Flipping Tables. I apologize that we haven't had these things on time, but between Cam and I running around and doing radio spots and whatnot, it has been ridiculous. I don't think I fully grasped the power of the NFL until, like, I went to one training camp and got, like, five media requests within, like, I don't know, a day and a half. Hey, can you come on our show? Hey, can you come on at this time? And it was like, are you serious? So, yeah, I think I'm beginning to understand the pulling power of the NFL, Cam, and it is just ridiculous compared to college.
Yeah, man. There's a reason why this is a $12 billion a year league, and it's because everybody wants a piece of the NFL. And yeah, you got to experience that firsthand. The Rams are back in L.A. There's a ton of media down there, and there's a lot of excitement around the Rams being back. And you go to one Rams practice, and you get just bombarded with requests because people want to know what's going on. I'm sure they want to know where Jared Goff is, how Todd Gurley looks, all those things. And the NFL is king right now.
Yeah, and it certainly was king when I was down there at practice the other day, and I got a good look at Jared Goff and Case Keenum, and I got to tell you, man, based on the reports that I've seen, and I know, see, when people tend to read these reports on Twitter, and they see, like, oh, there's a very realistic chance that Case Keenum could start, and Rams fans are like, no, there's not. We didn't give up all that to start Goff. Look, I'm telling you, right now, Case Keenum looks better. Like, to win this season, and we've talked about this on the podcast, though. We have. We had this very interesting discussion about whether or not it's more important to win now and ease Goff into it. I've kind of since slid over to the camp of saying, if Case Keenum continues to separate himself like he has been from Goff, I do think that you give Case Keenum, in theory, the first quarter of the season. And if he comes out of that brutal schedule with a winning record or at 500, I'm being dead honest here, Cam. I think you let him be the starter until he proves through his play that it's time to make a change.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on the situation. And look, I haven't been down there to watch these two guys compete in person and to really compare their play like you have. I've just kind of always been of the opinion that eventually Jared Goff is going to win the starting job. And I don't think they're going to, you know, I don't think they're going to give him the job because he's the number one overall pick and they gave up a bunch of picks for him and blah, blah, blah. I think he's going to get on a level playing field with Case Keenum in the preseason. And they're going to say, you guys are close enough in this competition that we're going to start Jared Goff because he's the future of this organization. If that doesn't happen, then I can totally see Case Keenum starting the season as the quarterback and it play out exactly like you said. If he has a successful first quarter of the season, if he is operating this offense in a way that keeps them in games, even if they don't necessarily win games at the beginning of their schedule, because their schedule to start out is tough, as we've gone over. You know, three out of four on the road and your one home game is the Seattle Seahawks. But if he's operating this offense in a way that is moving the ball, that is putting points on the board, and it's good enough to keep the Rams in games, it's going to be tough to make that change. Even if Jared Goff is performing, you know, really, really well during practice sessions, it's tough to make that switch if your offense is moving well. I still believe that Jared Goff is going to, because of the skill set he possesses, as the preseason moves on, I think he's going to get to where it's an even competition and he's going to win it. But it's entirely possible that it plays out exactly the way that you laid it out.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Jared Goff did. I just legitimately have seen that Case Keenum does have this handle on the team, on the situation that I think Goff is still easing into. You know, we talk about all the things that you want out of a quarterback. Goff can speak to the press. Goff has that swagger. He's got the interactions with the fans down pat. He's a guy that has all the physical tools as well to be the leader of this offense, and he can make some beautiful throws. But I think my issue just right now is I'm not sure if he's ready right now. And I did a lot of soul searching on this. Like, and I'm not saying that this situation is anywhere near the same. But I look at another guy who came out of Cal. And there was a lot of hype about him. And there were a lot of calls for him to start over a certain penis shot sending quarterback. And they didn't. They sat him behind Favre. And everything that we know about Favre says that Favre is an incredibly selfish human being who does not bother mentoring anybody. Like, this is documented fact about Favre. Like, he is not a mentor's mentor. And Aaron Rodgers has flat given interviews saying, I didn't learn a damn thing from that dude. Like, he hardly ever talked to me. Like, there's no love lost between those two. Rodgers knew it was time for the Packers to be his team, and Favre still felt like he had it in him. Unfortunately, one was right, one was wrong. But when you look at how much Rodgers grew just by sitting there sort of, I don't know, I guess it would be by osmosis since Favre wasn't teaching. And then you look at the man that he is today. Now, I think that there is something to be said, and I can already see the gears turning in your head. Yeah, but there's a significant difference between sitting behind Brett Favre and a guy like Case Keenan. I'll give you that. I will give you that. But if Case Keenum is actually willing to help Jared Goff understand the NFL game, and people forget he ended the season going 3-1, you know, it's not like this guy was a piece of crap slouch. Like, he won the final, you know, 75% of the Rams games at the end of the season last year. I think the guy who's willing to impart his wisdom is worth more than the guy who's read every book in the world and doesn't want to share it with anybody. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think you're right in when it comes to Aaron Rodgers. But there was no way that Aaron Rodgers was going to beat Brett Favre out early in his career, not because he was Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers was a late first-round pick, but just because Brett Favre was better. You know, he was a better quarterback. His physical skill set was still, you know, as good as anybody in the NFL. I mean, we had rules for Brett Favre that we didn't have for any other quarterback that played in the league. I mean, any other quarterback in the league. Brett Favre broke just about every rule that you have as a safety in the things that he could do physically. So, you know,
you played against him. Go on. Hack it on down, man. The dude was in your division. Tell me what I don't know.
Well, just, you know, you know, you said it, comparing Case Keenum and Brett Favre is it's not what you're doing. And that wasn't the point that you were making. The point that I'm making in that is that I think Jared Goff can perform as well as Case Keenum. Aaron Rodgers could not get to that level the first couple of years in the NFL. And here's what I mean. Like, we played a lot of cover two in Chicago. Everybody knows Lovie Smith cover two, you know, so we had certain rules. For instance, if a quarterback rolled out, so let's say, you know, a quarterback not named Brett Favre rolls out to his right and you're a safety, you know, playing, to the right side of an offense's formation. So the quarterback rolls away from you. Okay. You can come off the hash and come to the middle of the field because we're going to say that quarterback can't roll to his right and throw all the way back across the field and hit someone off the hash or on the numbers. So you can cheat to the middle of the field. With Brett Favre, you can't. And in fact, there was a clip we would play every year. It was 2002, the year before I got to Chicago. Cover two, our backside safety came to the middle of the field. Brett Favre stopped and threw back like 60 yards across the field to hit a wide open receiver. So from that point on, we put the Brett Favre rules in, and that's basically what it says. You cannot cheat when he moves to one side of the field or the other. Usually, and I mean every other quarterback in the league, there are a lot of strong arms in the league, but none could do what Brett Favre could do. So just physical skill set alone, you know, he was tough to unseat as the starter. But, you know, maybe Aaron Rodgers learned by watching Brett Favre on film. Maybe he learned because he does have some of the similar, you know, he kind of looks like Brett Favre in the pocket. He can move around a little bit. He's a slinger. He doesn't take as many risks as Favre did, but you know, maybe if Aaron Rodgers jumps in his second year, maybe he ends up the same guy. Maybe he doesn't. That's something that we'll never know. I think Jared Goff can get to the point where if you put his film on and you put Case Keenum's film on, that they will look pretty similar. And, you know, this is always kind of that quintessential question is, how much can you learn sitting behind somebody? You can probably learn a lot sitting behind Brett Favre. How much can you learn sitting behind Case Keenum? How much can you really learn with the skill set that Case Keenum possesses compared to the skill set that Jared Goff possesses? I think if you're Aaron Rodgers and you have a similar skill set to Brett Favre, you can learn a lot. If you're Jared Goff and your skill set is superior to Case Keenum, I think you learn how to operate something efficiently, how to not, you know, try to minimize mistakes. But as far as learning as much as Aaron Rodgers did just by sitting, I don't think Jared Goff would have the same experience sitting behind someone like Case Keenum.
And that's certainly a well-taken point. I think you have to consider, even if Brett Favre's not teaching, the quarterback coach is, and the quarterback coach will inevitably have understood that Favre was in no way, shape, or form taking Rodgers under his wing and would have explained to Rodgers, who's definitely smart enough to, he doesn't need Brett to explain it to him. He just probably needs someone. And I think at that end, you know, you have the quarterback's coach explaining to you exactly what Brett did, why it worked, why it didn't work. And for the record, and I fear saying this on a podcast, especially about the Rams, though I will never, ever, ever show any bias when the two meet. My Saints had no problem picking off a pass that Brett Favre tried to throw across the other end of the field.
yep, they probably had Brett Favre rules in place. That's why. They didn't cheat. They stayed backside, and he threw it, and they went and got it.
But I think, you know, getting back to the point, you're right. I don't know that Case Keenum is the kind of guy who's going to be able to give Brett Favre, or excuse me, Jared Goff, all that much information. And I do think that if you put a tape on of both of them, here's where I would slightly venture to disagree a little. I do think that Case Keenum, if you were to play film of them making the same throws and where we're at. I think Case Keenum's a bit further along. Some of the things that Jared Goff really needs to work on, and this has sort of been a concern of mine coming out of the Bear Raid system, is finding his progressions on the field. He's used to things, especially in that Sonny Dykes offense being go, 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 go. Like, that's the whole point of that system. You can find yourself in a rhythm very quickly because you're ripping off four or five passes in the same amount of time that an NFL team runs one play and maybe gets lined up for another. So there's going to be a point where Jared Goff has to master the progression part. Now, I'm in no way, shape, or form worried about whether or not he can master it. I think the guys, aside from the fact that he did not know where the sun sets and rises, I think the guy has an
useless information. Useless information.
Yeah. I think he felt better, though, when he asked Pharoh Cooper, and Pharoh Cooper gave the response of the air. You know, that's better than Goff thinking it rises in the West. I think here's what I at least appreciate about this situation, and then we can move on to some of the stuff about Hard Knocks. Regardless of who starts, the dynamic that I noticed out there is that, and I mean, and this even extends to Dylan Thompson, who probably won't even be with the team when the final 53 are made. Dylan Thompson and Sean Mannion and all those guys, they seem to have a tight-knit relationship. You know, Sean Mannion was even out there playing mentor to Dylan Thompson while Case Keenum was on the other side of the field playing mentor to Jared Goff. And then all the guys sort of just got together afterwards, and you can see that there is a genuine camaraderie. The Rams are sort of, I'm going to say, borrowing a line from the Trojans with this Ram family stuff, Ramily. It's certainly no coincidence that USC, their thing is the Trojan family. Jeff Fisher is a Trojan, and the motto for this year is Ramily. You know, like, I don't think that that's a coincidence. Jeff Fisher is, in a sense, getting back to his roots. He's getting these cast of characters, these talented guys, to buy into the belief that this family can accomplish anything. And I was on SB Nation radio last night, and I actually asked the host this. I said, if you were to remove, even with the current wide receiver personnel groupings, if you were to remove Jared Goff, Case Keenum from the situation and put not necessarily Peyton Manning from last year, but Peyton Manning in his prime on this Ram offense, how high would you have their ceiling? Like, what would you list them as with this defense and with the receivers that they have?
I think you would have to, I mean, and the fact that they have Todd Gurley, I think you would have to rate them. I mean, I think you'd have to put them in the top 10 of offenses. I mean, Peyton Manning changes everything. You know, if you have somebody like that, then, you know, it doesn't really matter who you have at receiver. Tom Brady's shown over the course of his career that he could have, you know, Julian Edelman was a quarterback in college, and he catches 100 balls for the Patriots, you know. So those types of situations, if you had Peyton Manning, he would find Tavon Austin 12 times a game. He would get to that 100 catch number Jeff Fisher was talking about. So I think a lot of the pieces would fit around a guy like that, and this would be a top 10, top 8 type of an offense. I just don't think they have enough firepower on the perimeter of this offense to put them in, like, the top 5 category. Now you're talking about, you know,
Antonio Brown and Super Bowl with. Like, at least with this team, like, look, we don't know much about Pharoh Cooper. But we know he and Tyler Higbee are certainly in the spot. We'll get to Tyler Higbee in a second because we got to have a Cam was right segment. But if you look at, I mean, Deion Branch was a Super Bowl MVP. Deion Branch, okay?
Right.
So you're telling me that if Tom Brady or Peyton Manning were on the Rams, that they couldn't make it work with Kenny Britt, Tavon Austin, and Pharoh Cooper? Like, you don't think they can make that work?
I think they could make it work, and I think it would be a top 10 offense. I do. I think it would be explosive. They have Todd Gurley. They do a lot of different things with Todd Gurley. They do a lot of different things with Tavon Austin. They would find him all over the field. Now you add a guy like Tyler Higbee in that can, you know, vertically threaten a defense down the middle of the field. And you have a group of weapons that would be utilized very well by quarterbacks like that. I just don't think that we're talking about a top five offense. Maybe if you look at the entire roster and we're going through the schedule and we're picking games, yeah, maybe this team ends up with one of the best five records in the NFL. That I can definitely agree with. But as far as this offense, with the lack of real weapons on the outside.
Would you, because I look at what Russell Wilson was able to win the Super Bowl with, and if we're being real, I think that the Rams defense is slightly better than the Seahawks defense, even in their prime. I just feel like, to a man, maybe Richard Sherman is obviously better than Trumaine Johnson, but I don't think Trumaine Johnson is so far behind Richard Sherman that it's a great concern. Now, there's some great safety play. I don't know how you feel, Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas. Earl Thomas is a stud. I'll give you that. But then on that same token, find me one dude on the Seattle defensive line, and Michael Bennett doesn't count, who is as beastly as Aaron Donald. Like, he just doesn't exist. There's only one Aaron Donald. And I think that if you look at who was, I mean, the Seahawks damn near won a second Super Bowl against the Patriots, and who was the leading receiver? Because I can't even remember his name.
I can't remember his name either.
Yeah, but you know who I'm talking about, right? They're like,
who the hell
is this dude? Like, and the Seahawks still almost won that game. Look, Kenny Britt is not a game-changing receiver. Tavon Austin is, but he doesn't have that size. So, to my mind's eye, this is, I guess, what I'm rolling around in my head. I look at some of the teams, like the Patriots, like the Seahawks, that have won Super Bowls with very, I don't want to say bland offenses, but if you were to look at teams like the Greatest Show on Turf, et cetera, some of the other high-profile offenses that have won Super Bowls, they're not them. These teams have won their Super Bowls, especially the Denver Broncos, with ridiculous defensive play. And I think that the Rams could match that ridiculous defensive play if they had a quarterback who were competent. Now, that's obviously why they went out and drafted Jared Goff, but I'm just looking back over those Super Bowls and trying to picture the Rams with a guy like Peyton Manning in those situations, and I can't for the life of me talk myself out of why they couldn't win one either in that situation. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I you know, I think we've talked about this a few times on this podcast. This Rams roster has been a playoff roster for a couple of years, minus the quarterback. You know, if they solidified that position, then I think this roster is ready to compete. Maybe not compete for an NFC West title, just because I think the Cardinals and the Seahawks are still just a step above. But I think they're competing for a playoff spot, and the Rams have been very competitive in the NFC West. The quarterback spot, to me, is the, the one area of concern. And now it seems like, you know, they have the answer to the future, at least. I just got to say, though, I think this Rams defense is going to be very good. I think Aaron Donald is going to be, I've said it, he's going to be the best defensive lineman in football.
I actually gave you a shout-out last night on SB Nation Radio. I said
appreciate
that my man Cam Worrell believes that Aaron Donald in a couple years might not just be the best defensive lineman in football, but just flat-out the best player in the NFL because he's so – maybe best is the wrong word, dominant. Dominant
yeah,
would be the word you're
right.
Looking for.
But I have to say this. This Rams defense is going to be good. I think they're going to make a ton of plays. They're going to keep the Rams in games. To compare them, though, to that Seahawks defense, and you know, Aaron Donald, I think you do have to leave him as the asterisk because he's a special player. But that Seahawks defense, it's kind of gotten they've gotten bits and pieces pulled away from that. So they're not the same unit that they were when they won the Super Bowl. But, I mean, they had Red Bryant, Chris Clemens, Tony McDaniel, Brandon Mebane. Those aren't names that jump off the page at you, but they were the best that I've ever seen front four guys playing the run of any defensive unit that I've ever really studied. And then you add in Bruce Irvin, who's a young guy, but explosive guy off the edge. Then you add in Michael Bennett. Then you have Bobby Wagner, who is, you know, a very, very, very good middle linebacker. And then that secondary, which take or leave Brandon Browner, I don't care. I thought he was always overrated. But
Malcolm Smith was due, too. I always thought Malcolm Smith, even going back to his days at USC, look, he wasn't a standout player by any sense of the word. I mean, at USC, he achieved a certain level of fame, but not really like the Leonard Big Cat Williams. What always stood out to me about Malcolm Smith was just the effort that he will give you on a continuous basis.
Yeah, and he and Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, I mean, none of these guys are really, except for Bobby Wagner, I think Bobby Wagner, I mean, he's a Pro Bowler. They are very good space linebackers. They're not guys that are going to, you know, play off of a block and make a tackle necessarily, but you put them in space, they're going to make plays. You put them in coverage, they're going to make plays. You let them go downhill, they're going to make plays. And they were just the perfect fit for this system. And then you add Cam Chancellor, who, you know, I think you can compare Mark Barron a little bit just in physical skill set, fit in there perfectly, and you throw Earl Thomas over the top of his defense, and you had something pretty special. So if you go man for man, I mean, you could compare this Rams defense to that Seahawks defense, but as a unit, that Seahawks unit fits so well with what they did that they were all time. They were all time. And I think people forget a little bit just how completely dominant they were at times in a time in the NFL where everything is catered to an offense.
This is going to put you in a tough spot here. But I'm going to ask you analytically, when you look at that Seahawks defense, you mention all time. There's another defense that comes to my mind, a defense that you'd be very familiar with, probably got a lot told to you about that defense while you were in Chicago. So you know where I'm headed with this.
Right.
Where do they rank against that 85 team?
To me, the Bears 85 defense is the greatest defense ever assembled. They just, you know,
they were abusive. They were just
they won three playoff games, but they gave up 10 points combined in every one of those playoff games. So, you know, you're just, to me, they are on a level all their own. There will never be another defense that is able to be as dominant as they were, especially, I mean, this, they went 15-1. They dominated in the playoffs. and dominated the Super Bowl. So to me, that defense is the greatest ever assembled. And it'll be tough for anyone ever to...
They lost to the Dolphins, didn't they?
Yeah, the Dolphins
That's sort of like a cruel irony, isn't it? Because that, if there was ever a team... Because you know the Patriots, even if they'd gone undefeated and won that, everyone and their mother would be talking about Deflategate, and there would be a permanent, non-official asterisk. But trust me, every time that season came up, the next sentence would be, yeah, but they cheated.
Yeah.
If the Bears had done it, we wouldn't... If the Bears had beaten the Dolphins, we would literally be talking... Because I think when you look at the 72 Dolphins, that was not this sounds hater. But you go through and you look at the stats... You go through and you look at the overall record of the teams that they played, and the combined record of everyone that they beat was under 500. I think the winning percentage for the teams that the 72 Dolphins beat on their way to a title was 463. I believe if I can remember my stat correctly from that article. 463. Like, you have a hard time convincing me that the Patriots going 18-0 before finally losing in the Super Bowl isn't somewhat just as impressive as the Dolphins playing two less games but beating up on a bunch of body bag opponents. Look, at the end of the day, you still have to win the games, and the Dolphins have the crown and the undefeated record. It's sort of like the Golden State Warriors. Forever, their 73-win season is going to be talked about. Yeah, at least Jordan won the crown, though.
Yeah.
You know, and yep. That's ultimately yep. What it comes down to. Jordan won the crown. So,
yeah.
I just want to move on real quick, talk a little bit of Hard Knocks before we move into the final four games of the schedule. I know that there will be a point in this series where you check out and we stop talking about it on this podcast. For those of you who listen, if you're a new listener, listen, Cam, for him, when it starts getting down to cut time, it's too real. It's something that he's been through, and it's not, he can't watch the pain of what he's been there. He's had that happen, and for him, It's sort of like if you picture, it's like an alcoholic, a recovered alcoholic not really wanting to step into a car. Not quite maybe the greatest parallel there, but the sentiment is very much the same. There are just situations that you don't want to put yourself in because it's all too real and too painful. So we will cover Hard Knocks up until a certain point, and then Cam will likely check out on it, and I'll do some coverage on it. But I want to ask your thoughts about at least the first episode. We discovered that Jared Goff has no idea where the sun rises and sets. We also discovered that when Jeff Fisher tells you don't bring any guests into your room, he means do not bring any guests into your room. But what were your impressions of what you saw? I guess the best thing to start out on, because this is what God asked of me. This is probably the most famous segment in the whole thing. But after Jeff Fisher cut Deion Anderson, he gave a very impassioned speech to the team. And I'm just going to use BS because, you know, we'd have to give the show an entirely different rating if I completely quoted Jeff Fisher. But he basically said, crap like what Deion Sanders did is 7-9 BS. And he is not going 7-9 this year, or 8-8, or 9-7, or even 10-6, he said. He said, this is a team that if you guys take care of yourself, and trust that I know what I'm doing, And I thought the point that he made with Tavon Aston, he said, how many bananas, what did you, you know, are you okay? You feeling better? Yeah. What did you have for lunch? And he holds up his ear and he's like, two bananas. And his teammates already started laughing at him because they knew. They knew. NFL players know. They're in tune with their bodies. You have two bananas and you went out there and practiced? Oh, come on, brother. And he says, look, we started out the day with two receivers down. Then all of a sudden we had, you know, a problem with, I think it was Coop, who was experiencing some tightness. And Fisher said he did the right thing. He came to us. We made the decision to shut him down. But then you had two bananas, and now we're down four receivers in a practice. It's the little things. And I thought that that was a really poignant statement right there. Because, like, I was sitting there thinking about that, and I'm like, you know, man, if you reflect on that, that's true. Those are the little things that hold a team back. And I just wondered what you felt about that sentiment from Fisher. And then we'll get into his comments about, I don't see this team even being a 10-6.
Yeah. Look, everybody, and I think Bill Belichick is probably the greatest example of this, just because he's had so much success for so long. And he's able to do it in the time in the NFL where you're not really supposed to have that much success for so long. But the results on Sunday in the NFL, you know, you cannot take care of small details and you can win football games. Like, that's just, that's entirely possible. But for you to win games that you maybe shouldn't win, or to beat an opponent that might be better, or to do that every Sunday for 16 Sundays in a row, you have to focus on very small details, because all those very small details add up to very large details, like wins or losses, or like scoring a touchdown or having to kick a field goal, things like that. So when you see Jeff Fisher talk about, like, we have to eat the right, we have to put the right things in our body if we're going to get enough out of this practice to do more the next practice, to do more the next practice, and then week one, we're actually ready to compete against another NFL team instead of still trying to work on the things that we weren't able to accomplish during training camp because guys didn't take care of themselves, or they didn't pay enough attention to the adjustments they have to make during a route based on the coverage that they see. All these things are not, you know, they are all connected. If you take care of the small details in one area of your life, you're going to take care of the small details in every area of your life. And if you don't take care of those details, it's going to seep into everything. And I think that was his point. It was, you know, if you eat two bananas for lunch one day, it's not going to make us a 7-9 football team. But if you're willing to do that and not take care of this detail, then you're not going to take care of the detail when it's 3rd and 8 and you have to adjust the route and your quarterback is not on the same page as you because we haven't gotten this work in. That was his point. Like, you have to take care of these details because in the end, a win is just nothing but small details being executed by one team and not the other. That's kind of what it comes down to in that league.
And then, were you a bit taken off guard when he said, I don't even see us as a 10-6 team? Because while I appreciate the confidence, Jeff Fisher, based on everybody that I've talked to, and I've by no means talked to every Rams fan, but based on the significant number of conversations I've had with analysts, writers, fans, I don't think that there's any expectation that this team is going to win 11 or 12 games. Never heard that. But if Jeff Fisher says that the team is better than 10-6, obviously that means he sees them winning 11 or 12 or 13, 14 games. This is the only logical deduction from that statement. Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and leave it there and let you pick up. I don't know even know what my question's going to be, because I feel like I've got so much I could say about it, but I don't want to be that guy. So I'm just going to let you pick up here. They're not a 10-6 team, according to Jeff Fisher. They're better. Agree? Disagree? Why?
Well, this is what I think. Look, I disagree with that. I don't think they're better than a 10-win team. I don't think that they're quite there yet, because we're uncertain about, you know, who the quarterback's going to be. And I think when you have a team with that uncertainty, it's hard to place them in that category. But what I think Jeff Fisher is doing, and what I know every single coach around the NFL is doing when they talk to their team, is they're saying, look, the potential to win more than 10 games is sitting in this room. And I think for the most part, if you look up and down the NFL, and we see it all the time, a team go from 7-9 to 12-4, or a team go from 6-10 to, you know, 11-5 and make that kind of turnaround, that there is the potential for most of the teams in the NFL to make that jump. I think that's what Jeff Fisher is saying. He's saying the potential in this room has the ability to win more than 10 games. Now, they are not anywhere close to where they need to be to even have the opportunity to do that. But, you know, if you're a head coach in the NFL and you're looking up and down your roster and you're looking at the pieces that you have, it's very easy to say, if these things happen, we can be this team. And I think that's what Jeff Fisher is saying. He's saying, if we take care of everything we need to take care of,
the little things
we can get right, the little things, if we can get, you know, everybody to play to their ability, that we have the opportunity to win double digit games. I don't think that they do. You know, I don't think that they sitting here right now can say that they're going to be a 10-win team. I just don't see that. But that's what Jeff Fisher is doing. That's what every coach around the NFL is doing. They're telling their team the exact same thing. We have the ability to win the NFC West. Nobody gives us a chance. We have the ability to win the NFC West. We can go 12-4. We can make it into the playoffs and make some noise. Every single coach is saying that to their team right now, because every coach is looking at their roster and they are saying, here's how we can get to 12-4. This is what has to happen to get to 12-4. Now, most teams aren't going to do that. They're not going to be able to do that, or they're not going to take every step necessary to accomplish that. But every coach is saying that to their team. Every coach right now sees their team as a competitor within their division, a competitor to make the playoffs and make some noise in the playoffs. That's what every coach is preaching to their team right now.
So the last two
points. Frankly, just real quick. Frankly,
yeah.
If you're going through training camp and look, it's not as much of a grind as it was when I was in, but if you're going through training camp and that's not the message you're hearing, it's very tough to wake up the next day and put forth some serious effort, because that's your expectation. If I'm putting in this work, it has to end with a positive result this year. So to hear that message helps you wake up and do it again the next day. Oh man, I really don't want to work today, but I want to win. So this is what I got to do. Without that message, it's man. Camp can get tough.
Right. If a coach walks in there and says, guys, I think you guys are at best a 6-win team, you know, but we're going to go out there and we're going to win those 6 games in the most dominating fashion. And I've outlined it. We're going to beat the Bills. We're going to beat the Browns, you know, so on and so forth. I think you would get the type of energy that you would expect at practice. Now, the last few points I want to bring up about Hard Knocks, which I think would be near and dear to your heart, is the first one is Mike Waffle. Holy crap! Was that guy just... Look, I am sure that that goes on with defensive line coaches around the league, but I think Mike Waffle's a certain kind of guy. I don't think that every defensive line coach is cut from the same cloth as he is. This is a guy who served his country, was a badass as a Marine, and is like, if you have a problem with me, come at me. I don't care how big you are, I'll knock you out. And I just thought, if you're an old white dude walking into a room with somebody the size of Robert Quinn you know, Quentin Coples and especially Aaron Donald, and that's your opening salvo, you've got my attention, that's for sure. But at the same time, the reason that he talks like that is because he wants that mentality in his players. And when you look at what he has gotten out of Aaron Donald, and they talked about it on Hard Knocks, they have never seen somebody like that. They've just never seen anybody with that body size, that type of effort, that type of brute strength. He's just a once-in-a-lifetime defensive line product. How important do you think Waffle's been to the success of the Rams? Because that defensive line is are straight up domestic terrorists. And I think that's the leader right there, man. He is leading a defensive line militia that is hell bent on taking over the NFL.
Yeah, that's, I mean, he is, he's like the quintessential defensive line, old school. I'm expecting this out of you because we're going to kick everybody's ass when we line up across from him, defensive line coach. I love it, man. I love it. Like playing in the secondary, you don't really, you don't get coaches with that type of mentality. I had a couple of special teams coaches that kind of operated that way, and I used to really enjoy it. I played for Pat Hill. Pat Hill will challenge you to a fight anytime you want to challenge him to a fight. Like, he's ready to go at all times, and that's what Mike Waffle was. I think he's going to be tremendous for this defensive line. I think hit that mentality is going to permeate through this defensive line group, and they're going to put that on the field. When you have somebody expect that type of mentality, that type of execution, that's what you end up as a group executing. And I think it's going to be, I think he's a tremendous asset for Jeff Fisher to have, because he has a group of incredibly talented defensive linemen. And when you have someone expect the things he's going to expect from this group, that there's going to be some pretty special things done this year.
And the last question I wanted to ask you, and there is no way in hell I was getting out of Hard Knocks without bringing this up. You look at Brandon Fisher, and I thought that there was a segment on that show where I chuckled. And I was like, dude, I bet Cam's got the biggest smile on his face right now. He was, and I hope you know what segment I'm talking about. They were getting ready to head out there to practice, and he's talking up to the DBs, and he's like, all right, we're going to protect so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so. The other guys, fuck them. We're going to kill them all. And it was just, I really like this. And no wonder the Rams deep, you know, because I'm learning about this team too. I'm trying to find out what makes these guys tick and what makes them such an aggressive defense. And when you see stuff like that coming out of practice, like, all right, gentlemen, we are going to protect this player, and this player. Now go decapitate the rest of them. Is that how if somebody had said that to you, if that was some of the instruction you'd been given, let's just say you're a player on Fisher, in Fisher's secondary, how do you respond to that?
You do exactly what he said. I mean, you go after the people he told you to go after, and you protect the people he told you to protect. That's just, I mean, that's what you do. As a group, that's how you operate. I mean, I love it, and yeah, those are exactly the type of conversations that you have. You know who the assets are. You know who you don't really, you know, want to end up around or be physical with whenever you're talking about training camp practices. But outside of that, let's go get it. I mean, you are – it's such an interesting dynamic because you're a team. You know, during training camp, it always ends up offense versus defense, just because all day, every day, that's the situation that you're in. And there are times in training camp, like, I mean, I had a huge fight Lovie Smith's first year in Chicago, because, you know, we had a night practice the night before, and Thomas Jones got lit up. And this is why. It's just a real quick story. Adrian Thomas is running the ball. Adrian Thomas gets, you know, runs a linebacker over. Okay, that linebacker retaliates on Thomas Jones, blows Thomas Jones up in a drill that's supposed to be just thud, nothing to the ground, blows him up. So the next day, Thomas Jones is still upset. Thomas Jones is running down the field, and, you know, in the secondary, you don't really thud in the open field. You just kind of tag off. Well, Thomas Jones decides to try to run one of our undrafted rookie safeties over. So he puts his shoulder down and hits our safety, and I come over and get into it with Thomas Jones. Well, Aaron Gibson, who was like 6'7", 340 pounds, comes over, and I'm not going to back down from anybody. So we get into it. We grab each other's face masks and start tussling a little bit, and it becomes this big brawl. So you get this offense versus defense mentality. You're competing every day. You start to operate like different units because you are different units. But at the end of the day, you have to know who your assets are. You know, you have to understand who you protect and who you can go after. And there are guys that you can go after and guys that you can't. And it, depending on who you are, if you go after the wrong guy, you're not going to be part of that team anymore. So, yeah, that's the mentality that you have, man. You're trying to go after everybody within reason, because it's you as a defense versus the offense. That's your opponent for that day. You're all trying to get better. You know, on Sundays, you'll be the same team, but for those practices, you are not at all teammates, you're competitors.
There was something I lied about wanting to close it up on Hard Knocks, but there's one last thing I wanted to ask, which really has nothing to do with Hard Knocks, kind of, but it's something that popped into my head when you were talking about training camp, and it feels to me. And like I said, I've played football, but certainly not at the level you ever have. But it feels like there is an element of training camp that is supposed to be about team building, but it is very much every man for himself, because nobody else out there is going to make you look good. They're, in fact, trying to make you look bad, because if you look bad, they can take your spot. How much of that dynamic is in play, but is balanced out by the camaraderie of the team? Because it seems as if, though, like if I put this a different way, the goals are almost inherently working against one another. You want to build a team, but in order to do that, you have to find out which guy is better. It's sort of like, I don't know if you watch John Oliver, but he was talking about the Olympics and saying, like, they were making a joke about, you know, oh, the spirit of the Olympics is that we're all equal. No, the Olympics is, in fact, a once every 4-year deal designed to give one country superiority over another. There is nothing equal about the Olympics. Not everybody gets a trophy. And I feel that same dynamic as a play in training camp. And I guess I just wanted to ask someone who's been through it, how do you juxtapose knowing that you have to go out there and do what's right by you so that you make the team, but at the same time not showing these coaches that you're some sort of self-centered asshole? Because that's where I think I'd struggle.
It's funny because I had this conversation with my wife last night. We were watching Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte race in the semifinals of the 200 IM, and she said, man, it's got to be so tough to compete against someone in a race and still, you know, be friends, have a relationship, you know, just not have that come in between everything that you do. And I said, no, it's not really hard at all. And an example was Todd Johnson was a safety who drafted by the Bears the same year that I got to the Bears, 2003. I never would have had an NFL career, honestly, if it wasn't for Todd Johnson, because the first preseason game, he breaks his jaw, right? He was the second team free safety. I was the third team free safety. He was a fourth round pick. I was an undrafted free agent. He breaks his jaw. That gives me the opportunity, the three other preseason games and training camps, to earn a spot. So every year we were in Chicago, we played 4 years together in Chicago. Every year in the preseason, if you read the papers, if you watch the news, it was Todd Johnson versus Cameron Worrell. One of these guys is going to make the team. One of these guys are going to get cut. And we ended up playing together for 4 years, and we're still really good friends today. I talk to him all the time. The dynamic is, it's interesting. I mean, it's really crazy. The reason why it works, here's the only reason why it works. It's because, yeah, you are, as someone competing for a roster spot, you are only concerned with your performance. You're only concerned with how you're doing on practice, what you're putting on film, how you're stacking up against everybody else. But the common thread is every single player in that training camp is focused on the same thing. And there are, you know, there are guys, obviously, like Aaron Donald, who's not focused on, you know, maybe necessarily 100% his own performance, but maybe the performance of his defensive line group or the defense as a whole. There are established guys who are able to do that. But for the most part, if you have 90 guys in training camp, 70 of those guys are focused only on themselves. But everybody understands that we're all competing for the same thing. We're all interested on making this roster. And if we do make this roster, having the best group of 53 guys on this roster. So because you're all working for the same goal, it just kind of works. You respect everybody else because you know that they're trying to accomplish the same thing you are. And on the field, you want to kick their ass every single snap. But after you're off the practice field and you're in the locker room, you have that mutual respect and appreciation for somebody else's career, for somebody else's goals. And that's the only reason why it works. If it was just a group of guys who were looking out solely for themselves, I don't know if it would work. But because there's just a mutual understanding and respect that everybody is trying to make themselves better, give themselves a better opportunity, put food on the table for their family, you know, that's why those training camp practices, it just works.
If I understand you correctly, the best way that you summarize it is that the guys who are forced to, because I think that there's an element that we have to recognize that these are guys who are forced to look out for themselves. If you're an undrafted free agent, there's no choice.
Right.
Like, you have no choice. There's not going to be anybody else who's going to be able to save you or your job if you don't look out for yourself. But that's balanced out heavily by guys who are rock solid and secure in their positions, guys like Robert Quinn, guys like Michael Brockers, guys like Mark Barron, guys like Aaron Donald, so on and so forth. Am I understanding you correctly there?
Yeah, I mean, there are those guys who have a team first approach. But, you know, when you have a group of 90 guys, all they're trying to do is get better so they can make a roster. When you have that kind of group mentality, even though people are focused on themselves individually, like, you end up collectively with a group that is much better when training camp breaks than they were day one, because they're all competing for a spot on this roster. So because of that, your end product is a team full of guys who are the best players they could possibly be, and that's the best group of players from those 90 that you could possibly grab. Yeah, you have those Brian Urlachers or Olin Krutz who make sure that everybody understands that, look, I know you're focused on you, but this is not about you. This is about us. It's about the finished product. And you know that. I'm telling you, the mentality of guys or the intensity from, you know, that last training camp practice to the first practice of the regular season, or the middle of training camp to the first practice in the regular season, it's so much different because you're not competing anymore. Like, you're not competing with the guy sitting next to you for one spot. You know, you're still competing to get better every day, you know, and all that stuff. You're trying to win football games, but it's just, it totally changes. As soon as you make the team, you know, you don't have that fierce competition within, you know, your group anymore. Now people are secure and you're able to build as a team. But, you know, it's just collectively, because you're trying to get better, your team is better because of that. And that's just, that's kind of how it works. You just, you have selfish guys sometimes who, you know, will try to undercut somebody else's career for their own benefit. But for the most part, you're talking about a bunch of professionals who understand what's at stake. And that's why you're able to compete at such a high level. Although the training camp practices now, they're not really the same, man. They're not the same as when they were. So the dynamic might be a little bit different now. I know guys are not as intense. It's not as physical as it was. You know, you don't have as many opportunities to really make a squad in practice, but you know, there's still that dynamic of people trying to make a roster and competing every day to try to do that.
Well, in the interest of time, I think what we're going to do is I think that we are going to talk about only two games, and then that'll leave us six to talk about next week. So that'll give us basically an entire podcast worth of nothing but football plus a recap of the Dallas Cowboys game. Actually, maybe we'd better be served by just leaving all the games and finishing them out next week and talking about the Dallas Cowboys.
I think that'd be great.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to put away this year thingy that has the schedule open and close it, and we will discuss those games next week. Let's talk about the Cowboys here before we wrap things up. How do you see this game? Well, I'm not going to say play out. Let's say, how do you see this game lining up for starters? What do you think we're going to see in terms of the quality of the product put on the field? Understanding that it's the first preseason game, what do you expect to see from both teams?
I mean, I think especially defensively, I think we will see this first team defense of the Rams get a couple series. You know, maybe Aaron Donald doesn't get a series, maybe Robert Quinn doesn't, but I think for the most part, you're going to see this group. Alec Ogletree definitely will be in the middle of this defense, making some calls. You do want to get him a little bit of work, and I think this offensive line as a group will get some work. So that's what we'll see. Case Keenum's going to start. I don't expect Todd Gurley to get a carry. I don't expect him to play at all. So we'll see bits and pieces of what's, you know, going to be the opening day starting lineup for the Rams. And for the Cowboys, you know, no Tony Romo, no Jason Witten, no Dez Bryant. You know, you won't see those guys on the field. You won't see the real Dallas Cowboys offense on the field. But, you know, I think we'll get a couple of series with some pieces that will make an impact, you know, in the regular season. You know, Tavon Austin might get some work. Kenny Britt might get some work. But this is really a big opportunity for the young players to get a lot of good work in. That's, you know, what I think the focus should be on in the first preseason game is look at the young pieces that, you know, you expect to make an impact this year or you're hoping can make an impact this year, and how do they handle their first real live NFL action. I think that's what you can focus on. And there's always going to be, you know, a couple guys that jump off the screen at you that you didn't expect. And I mean, I tell this story all the time, but my first preseason game with the Bears, you know, the first three quarters, I don't get a snap. I'm on the sideline for three quarters, which I had never done in my entire life. Okay. Never have I just sat and watched a football game with pads on for three quarters. So I sit for three quarters. I finally get an opportunity to play in the fourth quarter, and I go in, I make four tackles. I make a tackle on the punt team, and, you know, a guy who was just a third team safety getting, you know, practice reps and being a decent practice player. I turned it up on game day, and I jumped off film at the coaching staff. And that, coupled with the fact that, as I mentioned before, Todd Johnson broke his jaw, I got a real opportunity to make the roster, and I made the roster, and I stuck around for 6 years in the NFL. That's the type of performance that we'll see out of somebody, and you never know who it is, and that's what's kind of cool about the preseason, is that you'll have guys that you really don't know much about jump off and really make some big plays. I mean, I honestly, that quarter, the first quarter I ever played as a professional football player, helped me stick around the NFL for 6 years. And I'm not just saying that to pump this first preseason game up, but I really mean that. The coaching staff had seen me in practice, but, you know, I always worked hard in practice. There's just, it's something different when the lights come on. Sometimes guys turn up when the lights come on. Sometimes guys are just the same player.
To quote Avatar, they finally saw you.
Right. Finally. And they were like, oh, wow. Okay, this kid really turned up. And then, you know, preseason game two, I'm starting on every special team. You know, I you know, play about 2.5 quarters of defense and make a couple big hits and just, you know, kind of solidified what I had put on film. But that's a couple guys will do that. We'll have guys that were like, man, you know, I had no idea this guy could play like this. And he just jumps off film at you because, I mean, when the lights turn on, they turn up. They go at it. And that's what's cool about preseason games. And that's what I expect. I don't expect that we see a lot of, you know, established guys getting a lot of reps, but we'll see a lot of young guys getting reps, and we'll find a couple guys that we really hadn't spoken about a lot, and we'll be talking about them next week.
Well, in that same vein, because we only have two last items to cover, one of which I'm sure you'll have no problem with because we'll be singing your praises about Tyler Higbee. But I'm going to remove him as an answerable candidate for the following question. If you put your money on paper, who do you think are going to be one of those guys, one or two names, that could potentially jump out that you and I will be sitting here next week and talking about? And remember, Tyler Higbee is not an available option for this question.
I think the first person I would put on that list would be Duke Williams. You know, undrafted receiver out of Auburn, has the physical, you know, makeup of a big, you know, big bodied receiver. You know, has had his issues kind of off the field, but a guy with a lot of potential that, you know, I mean, we're talking about an uncertain, you know, receiver group. Who's going to be number three? Who's going to play out of the slot? You know, who's going to be the big body across from Kenny Britt? There are a lot of unknowns in this receiving group, and I think, you know, there are some opportunities for, you know, Mike Thomas, who I know you like, or Duke Williams.
Yeah,
know,
Mike Thomas, unfortunately, isn't quite coming as good as I thought maybe. I'm sort of losing the battle on that one.
Duke
seems to have taken his place.
Yeah, there are opportunities within this group, and I think Duke Williams is a guy who's going to, you know, look, you play in the SEC, you make big plays in the SEC, it's just, you know, you've played at the highest level of college football and you've made plays in some very intense situations. And I think that just kind of helps somebody like Duke Williams go into an opportunity like this and take full advantage. So I expect him to have a big game. Another guy who I don't know if we're necessarily going to be talking about him, but I'm really interested in seeing Jordan Lomax, who is a guy who I really liked watching in college, a guy that I thought would be somebody drafted, free safety out of Iowa, but who's a physical player. Haven't read a lot about him in training camp up to this point, but I expect him, you know, you play on that Iowa defense, you play for Kirk Ferentz, you're a physical player and you understand how to play solid defense. So I'm really interested in seeing what he does, and hoping that, you know, he's able to take advantage of an opportunity that he gets. Cause I loved watching him in college. That Iowa defense was fun to watch until they went up against Christian McCaffrey in the Rose Bowl. But
that Iowa offense, on the other hand,
they're dominated.
But let's be real, dude. I mean, Christian McCaffrey's made far better defenses. And Iowa are damn good defense. But I'm reasonably sure that Christian McCaffrey could pop for 200 against Alabama. And I mean that seriously. I think that McCaffrey is that type of player, and it doesn't hurt that Stanford has an offensive line and jumbo set packages designed to spring holes that you could drive a Mack truck through. Like, and once Christian McCaffrey gets going, bruh, you're not stopping him. I don't care about SEC speed, Big 12 speed. The kid is just fast.
Yeah, he's fast. He's got some wiggle to him. It's going to be interesting to see, not to get totally off on Christian McCaffrey, but it's going to be interesting to see how he is able to transition into the NFL. And I know he still has, I mean, he's only a junior at Stanford. I don't expect him to play after his junior year at Stanford. I expect him to go make some actual money, some real get paid for doing what he does. But he reminds me of Reggie Bush. That's who he reminds me of in his body type and his skill set. He's very elusive in the open field.
I think he's a little more physical. Better between the tackle or runner, though.
Right. Yeah, I think so too. I think he's a little better, running out of, you know, a pure eye formation and running physically, but he's also 190 pounds and those guys don't last in the NFL carrying the football between the tackles. So it's going to be interesting to see. The game is different now than when Reggie Bush came out. You know, now the game is so much more played in space that, you know, Darren Sproles doesn't exist 20 years ago. Darren Sproles is a huge weapon these days. Danny Woodhead is 5'7". He's a huge weapon these days. So there are other ways you can utilize skill sets like Christian McCaffrey. But it's going to be interesting to see. He's going to be a top five pick. You know, he's so explosive, but how he's used in the NFL, I'm very curious to find out.
Honestly, I think one of my favorite things about McCaffrey is that he runs routes as well as any wide receiver. I mean, you could, in theory, convert him to a slot receiver and in the vein of like a Danny Amendola or a Wes Welker, and I think he'd be fine. Truthfully, I mean, the way that he runs, the way that he turns his feet over is akin to world-class sprinters. That's the motion he's using to turn over those feet. And that's why it looks like he's such a blur. It's because, you know, we talked about the theme of this podcast, and actually the title of this podcast will be The Little Thing. It is the little things that make a huge difference, and McCaffrey has obviously tremendous pedigree, but I think one of the things that helps him is that he truly focuses on the little things. He gives himself every chance to succeed. You know, I was watching the linemen and the linebackers go through their drills with the bags where they're punching up. And I can't remember who it was. I'm drawing a blank right now. The coach that was giving the talk, but he was basically saying, like, keep your hands up. See, try and punch, throw 1-2. You know, you see, like, with your hands up, it works so much better. You put your hands down. This is wasted motion. This is second loss. These are the little things. So too with McCaffrey, the way he turns those feet over and gets going, I think, is something special, man. This kid is, yeah, like you said, don't want to spend too much time talking about him, but I kind of do.
Yeah, maybe Marshall Faulk is a better example. You're talking about him running routes out of the slot. You know, Marshall Faulk is a guy that can do that. Marshall was smaller. He was built a little broader. But, you know, Christian McCaffrey still has a lot of years to grow into an adult body. So we'll see. Definitely an interesting product.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, and I guess the final thing that I want to talk about today with regard to the Cowboys game is putting you on the spot with the ever-elusive, pointless prediction as to how the game will go. The Rams, even though it's a preseason game, I think will be hoping to win this one. It's your first game in Los Angeles. It's the first game with your fans, and if we're being real, St. Louis people, sports writers who still have some, you know, responsibility for covering the team, or will, you know that they will jump all over that. I guess I'm just curious. Do you think the Rams stumble out of the gate against the Cowboys? Does it matter if they stumble out of the gate? And do they, as stupid as this question sounds about a preseason game, just with four straight seasons of 7-9, if your opening debut in the Coliseum is an ass-kicking at the hand of, you know, the third-string Cowboys, you and I both know what the narrative will start to be coming into the season. And at that point, they then become a distraction. So I guess, as dumb as the question is, how important is it that they win this game, and can they do it?
Yeah, they can do it. I mean, it all kind of comes down to who plays who for how long, and, you know, how long until you get into your third-team offensive line, because as soon as the third-team offensive line comes in, everything goes downhill. You know, we're going to talk about the result next week. Fans are going to put something in. You know, I see Raiders fans around Fresno who, like, really care about preseason performances. I'll tell you this, man, like I said, every player is focused on themselves and their performance. Not one player at all cares whether they win or lose this preseason game. Nobody cares. NFL players don't care at all about preseason games. All they care about is getting out healthy and being better for the week after. I mean, that's it. So,
administration? Do they care?
No, I think they all. Jeff Fish is going to come out and say, hey, every time you're on the field, you want to win. If there's a winner and a loser, you want to be a winner and not a loser. Yeah, okay, that's a great statement to make for the media. Nobody cares. Stan Kroenke doesn't care. Les Snead doesn't care. Jeff Fisher really doesn't care. At the end of the day, you just want to see guys perform, because this is an interview that you only have four of them in the preseason. This is the biggest one for younger, unknown guys, though, because week two, usually your starters play, you know, about two quarters. Week three, they play, you know, maybe into the second half. And then week four, they don't play at all. And after, you know, after week three, you're pretty much, you have your roster pretty set. So this is the biggest opportunity for those young players. If you cared about winning the game, you would play your starters. You know, you would. If you cared about winning, you would play your legitimate players. Aaron Donald would play the whole game if he wanted to win. But that's not the way the preseason is set up. That's not especially the way the first preseason game is set up. So we'll talk about it. You don't want to get your butt kicked. You know, you don't want to have your first opportunity to play in the Coliseum in front of your LA fans just, you know, getting beat 42-7 or anything like that. But you don't really care if you win or lose. You'll tell the fans you do, but you really don't care at all.
That's fair enough, good sir. Well, on that note, what do you have coming up this week, and where can the peeps locate you on the Twitters, as the young ones say?
Yeah, I'm just on the radio, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. If you want to check it out, 3 to 4 every day, 1 to 3 on Friday. At Cam Morrell is the Twitter. I have a Snapchat. I don't know what's it. I think it's at Killer Cam Morrell, which is my old football nickname that I stopped using after I got out of football because it doesn't really, you know, make sense just being an everyday person and having the nickname Killer. So that's where you can find me on Snapchat or you know, Twitter's at Cam Morrell. So I'll be post some links to this stuff I lay down here in Fresno. Other than that, it's just doing the radio thing every day.
Right on, and you can find me on Twitter at SideOnTwist. I will be obviously still doing stuff for LA Rams Report on Scout. And also with Turf Show Time. So keep it locked right here. And next week, we will finish out our complete preseason look at the Rams 2016 regular season. So for Josh, me, I don't know why I said that, for Cam and myself, I just want to say thank you all for listening and send in those listener questions. We forgot to put out a post this time. Our bad. But we'll be back to answering listener questions next week. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. And keep it locked right here to LA Rams Report on Scout.com, your home for all things Los Angeles Rams.